Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Living with Chronic Myelogenous Leukemia, or CML. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as leukemia and MPN and CML organizations. And it's because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. So we have on the call today over 668 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Bangladesh, Canada, Kenya, Russia, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's really a credit to you that you're choosing to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program was made possible by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Pfizer, and Teva Pharmaceuticals. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program and also for their corporate collaboration in making today's program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow, and Dr. Morrow is Leda, Myeloproliferative Neoplasms Program, Attending Physician Leukemia Service, member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Morrow is going to address an overview of chronic myelogenous leukemia, current standard of care and new treatment approaches, adherence or taking your pills on schedule, and the importance of treatment summaries. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Morrow.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, everybody, for joining in. What a broad audience we have. So for the next 30, 40 minutes or so, we're going to speak about CML. And my topics are first to give you an overview of CML, talk about our standard treatment and some novel treatment approaches, talk about adherence of taking medication with CML, and the importance of using treatment summaries or having your own results available to you if you have CML or you're with someone who has CML. So one of the first things I like to say is that CML in 2015, fortunately, is now a highly treatable and we're very hopeful that it may be a functionally curable disease. Our improvements in treatment have been dramatic over the last 15 years, and I'll share some thoughts on that with regards to treatments in just a moment. But making the diagnosis of CML brings us back in history because CML was really the first human cancer to be linked to a discrete genetic abnormality, the Philadelphia chromosome. So back in 1960, it was recognized that patients with CML had a unique molecular signature, or at least at that point, a unique genetic signature, a short chromosome 22 called the Philadelphia chromosome. And with the scientific research armamentarium available then and through the decades that followed, we really unraveled what makes this disease tick and learned exactly what BCR-ABL, the product of the Philadelphia chromosome, did and how to potentially inhibit it or stop it with our targeted therapies. Now, Gleevec was the first drug for CML, and there are now five FDA-approved oral medications that are TKIs, or tyrosine kinase inhibitors. These are small chemical molecules or more oral medications that are small molecule medications that are designed to block and stop the activity of an abnormal or activated cell. And the good news is that they're very narrow and fairly discreet in what they do. They're not perfect in that they don't just treat CML. They have some side effects, which my colleague will speak about in a little bit more. And they do have other potential downsides. But overall, they are very much an advance in cancer therapy and really have set the stage for the way we like to treat all cancers and really even non-cancer diagnoses. Making the diagnosis of CML, if one is suspected of having or has symptoms related to, hasn't changed that much in that we first look for the typical signs and symptoms. If someone has often symptoms that are hard to pin down, such as night sweats, weight loss, fever, abdominal or belly symptoms from their spleen being enlarged, fatigue, bruising, bleeding, and those, which are always a common potential symptom for leukemia, those are some of the potential signs. As physicians and leukemia specialists, our task is to, in this diagnosis, if the suspicion is clear, is to determine that this Philadelphia chromosome molecular abnormality or genetic abnormality is present, because that really makes the diagnosis. That can be done by blood-based testing. It often is recommended that bone marrow testing be done, especially early on in CML, to understand the full spectrum of the disease and to make sure that it hasn't gone into a more advanced stage like accelerated or blast phase. in a word, those are when CML patients may be having increasing difficulty with their blood counts and enlargement of the spleen. And CML, either with treatment or sometimes rarely, although possibly in the beginning, can appear like acute leukemia, meaning that it'll have the same clinical and physical signs and symptoms for patients and needs to be treated differently. Unfortunately, that's rare. Most people are diagnosed in chronic or early stage. Most people don't have a lot of symptoms. They're often diagnosed by serendipity. They have a blood test for another reason, or they're going in for other medical procedures and something is noticed that induces an evaluation that then leads to the diagnosis. One of the most difficult questions regarding CML today is really the great problem we have, which is choosing initial therapy. There are three FDA-approved treatments for a newly diagnosed CML patient in chronic phase: imantinib or Gleevec, nilotinib or Tasigna, and dasatinib or Sprycel. And these drugs all have significant benefit for patients. They're all head and shoulders above our previous treatment, which was interferon-based treatment, although that drug still has some use. And some of the benefits we've seen with Gleevec have been clearly that we've made this a treatable and probably functionally curable disease, that the overwhelming majority of patients will go into remission, which occurs in steps. Let me just cover that in the next moment. When someone's diagnosed with CML, their blood counts are often abnormal. Their white blood cell count is really needs to be high or should be high to confirm the diagnosis, although rarely it is minimally elevated. And in fact, if the Philadelphia chromosome is present, that really makes the diagnosis. But the white count is almost always high. The platelet count or the clotting cells can sometimes be high, sometimes be low. And some patients have anemia. And the blood looks different. There are immature cells in the circulation which shouldn't be there. They should only be in the bone marrow. So the first step is correcting that and bringing on what's called a hematologic response. That generally happens within the first few weeks of treatment, and the blood counts normalize. And when they're no longer elevated and the spleen is no longer enlarged, that's the first step along the path. We then have, especially in the last few years, have focused increasingly on how fast is the leukemia regressing. And we judge that by determining how fast the molecular signs of the disease, by a test called PCR, improve, and the standard approach at this point would be at 3 months to make a pretty careful decision that the leukemia has reduced perhaps by tenfold, or it's one-tenth of its original size, and probably more importantly, to look at the person's individual starting point and seeing relative to that expectation of a 10% level from the start, how has the individual person's level dropped. That really sets the stage for very good odds of someone going on to deep remission over the ensuing next few months and having a very good long-term outcome. So we've put, again, a lot of energy into molecular diagnostics, and it's important for people with CML or those who know someone with CML, caring for someone with CML, to seek the best molecular testing available. We need to look at it on a standardized scale where we can all understand the results and the value that we get. It's called the International Standard, or IS. And it's important for patients all to ask about their PCR results so they can get the information and understand what it means. And because it's very important to early response, and it's important for the long term as well. So if the first step would be getting the blood counts to normalize and the spleen to be no longer enlarged, that's a hematologic remission. In the first 3 to 6 months, we look for the molecular or PCR or polymerase chain reaction based testing to improve. Along the way, the patient will go into what's generally called the equivalent of a cytogenetic remission, where the bone marrow, if rechecked, or if similar tests that are done in the blood are checked and show that the level of leukemia has fallen below the point where the bone marrow would show leukemia any longer, the next step on the ladder is achieved, and someone has now passed into what's called a complete cytogenetic remission. This is when the leukemia is about 100 times smaller than its original size. At that point, the blood counts clearly would no longer be elevated. Patient's symptoms should be minimal from the disease or gone, and hopefully side effects from treatment haven't become intolerable or worse. And my colleague, Dr. Tibbetts, is going to talk a bit more about side effects in his portion, so I'll leave that to him. As we get deeper into CML, the next step along the way would be the deeper molecular remissions. And this has been also an increasingly important focus, because the good news is that the overwhelming majority of patients will clear these early hurdles and get to a point where the leukemia is shrinking to levels where it becomes only detectable by blood-based molecular testing, and even to the point where it may not be detectable any longer by molecular blood-based testing. And those remission levels are called major and complete molecular remissions. They're a little bit of a misnomer, because just because we can't see it doesn't mean there may not be a very small signal remaining, but that doesn't mean the patient's not doing very well and might actually do very well over the long term. Essentially, our treatment has improved a bit faster than our technology to detect the small amounts of leukemia that can remain in a patient who's doing phenomenally well and is in deep remission. So achieving a molecular remission with leukemia is 1,000 times smaller than its original level, which is 10 times deeper than a bone marrow level remission. We expect that to occur by the first year to year and a half, and that's likely to happen with all of our drugs. If you look at the studies that compared Gleevec, our standard drug, to nilotinib and dasatinib, or Tasigna and Sprycel, those drugs in studies compared to Gleevec really showed that the deeper molecular remissions happened earlier and happened in a higher proportion of patients, the earlier molecular remissions as well. So that's some of the benefits of using the newer drugs at diagnosis and that careful decision we make about which is the best drug for patients at diagnosis. It's a balancing question between, are there any concerns about side effects or risks versus how much benefit a patient can derive based on the data I just told you, that molecular and deeper remissions clearly are improved with our newer drugs. Some of the more recent questions we have, or the sort of newer treatment approaches, are really addressing an important question, is that is CML therapy necessary to take indefinitely? It may be that with deep molecular remission that's noted to be ongoing for a number of years, that patients, not in general practice, but may be eligible for clinical studies which are asking the question about treatment interruption. And again, I want to emphasize that this isn't something we do in standard practice at this point, but we're clearly asking questions about that, and that'll be a tremendous breakthrough if we're able to determine that some or maybe a majority of patients may have a defined duration of treatment rather than treatment indefinitely. But right now, CML is expected to be a treatment you take over the long term, a maintenance treatment over the foreseeable future. But the future is very hopeful on that. Some of the other newer developments are addressing the real question that remains, and that some patients don't always respond best to treatment and may lose their response and unfortunately sometimes have a loss of response or progression. So novel agents have been developed, particularly ones that will target the BCR-ABL or Philadelphia chromosome product differently. One new exciting drug that's in clinical development is a drug made by the same folks that developed Gleevec and Tasigna called ABL-001, which is an inhibitor of this Philadelphia chromosome product by a slightly different mechanism and is showing great promise. It's in very early clinical trials, but we'll stay tuned and look for that. So in the last few minutes, I want to make two additional important points, and that's how important it is to take medication in CML. We've actually shown in research studies about how strong an impact a minor difference in adherence or ability to take medication daily or as prescribed can make. Some of our studies show that as little as missing a few doses a month, more than 3 doses a month or 3 days a month of treatment can significantly impact someone's odds of getting into a deep remission, as I just described, is really our goal of treatment and is very likely to happen. Now, that's not blaming someone for not being able to take their medications. There are a lot of hurdles. First, understanding the importance and being able to manage taking it, especially some of the more complex regimens. One of the medications we often will look to prescribe at diagnosis requires taking it on an empty stomach, taking it twice a day. One of the other medications, their first medication is Tasigna. Sprycel or dasatinib often is a medicine you really can't take that medication with medicines that block stomach acid or what are called proton pump inhibitors. And Gleevec has side effects as well. So we have to, as physicians and patients and as a community, have to realize what the challenges are early on and make sure that there aren't any barriers to adherence and that everything is understood and help get those deep responses that are really feasible by as close to perfect adherence to treatment as possible. And ask your doctor and ask your healthcare team about side effects and problems if they're there, because it's our job to manage them. I want to stress that. Another thing that's good to do as part of the care team would be to think about a treatment summary, to know your treatment. Many people with CML have been dealing with it for a long period of time. This is a chronic illness that may be in deep remission and may be very manageable. Still on treatment, but response is still ongoing, monitoring is still ongoing, results are still coming in, and it can be a marathon. So one of my favorite things is having a patient who might have what's called a shadow chart or a, you know, folder where they've gotten the results. They've taken notes about their times they've been on medicines, times they might have stopped, their milestones that their doctors or their healthcare team has shared with them. So I can review that with them, and we can have an overview of how things have gone, because it's not often a short history. And the good news is it's increasingly a longer and longer history. So I'm going to close by saying that, again, CML is a highly treatable and, again, I hope it's going to be a functionally curable disease, and I wanted to just share some thoughts on my topics, and I'll hand over to my colleagues to share some other important thoughts about some other topics in the remaining time. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mora. That was really outstanding and just very informative. Thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Raul Tibbis, and Dr. Tibbis is a consultant and director, acute and chronic leukemia program, division of hematology and medical oncology, scholar in clinical research, Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, assistant professor, Mayo College of Medicine, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. Dr. Tibbis is going to address the role of clinical trials and how research improves treatment options, managing post-treatment side effects, late effects, benefits of follow-up care, and communicating with the healthcare team about your quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Tibbis.
Well, thank you very much, Caroline, for the introduction, and thank you, my colleague, Dr. Mauro, for an excellent overview introduction into the topic. So I think the role of clinical trials is very important for medicine in general. And for the audience who were not involved in the initial stages, how all of those great drugs that we currently have for CML patients were developed, CML is actually the poster child of modern molecular-targeted therapy in cancer, not just for leukemias or CML, but for a lot of other solid cancers as well. We could only make those advances through clinical research, meaning through clinical trials and patients participating in clinical trials. I tell my patients always that most or almost any of the drugs we are currently taking, including your blood pressure medication or your medications or your antibiotics, they all started in the baby steps in a clinical trial. And often the first couple of patients have been treated in the world with a specific medication. And for CML and for those BCR-ABL specific tyrosine kinase inhibitors, they were truly a breakthrough in modern targeted medicine. So this was only possible because patients didn't have those drugs available. They were able to get them on the clinical trial, and then we were able to learn a lot, including some of the points Dr. Mauro mentioned with monitoring of the disease truly at the molecular level and all of the questions we are right now in 2015. So I would continue to encourage every patient to participate in a clinical trial if there's a trial available close to them or in the cancer center or in the private practice office, wherever the patient's being treated. Because we have learned a lot, and fortunately CML has become a chronic disease, but I think there's still several topics and several questions to be learned, as we mentioned earlier. Can we stop tyrosine kinase inhibitors at any point in the treatment of a patient? I think this should be investigated only in a clinical trial. So if a patient wants to stop their BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase inhibitor, my current recommendation is not to do it with your private doctor in the office, but it really should be done under very well-monitored circumstances, because there's a risk of just stopping the drug, even though a patient has been in a very deep molecular remission for a long period of time. So in order to learn more, I would encourage to look into clinical trials. And I mentioned the next big thing is, can we stop these tyrosine kinase inhibitors? And again, there are several trials that have been published and other trials are ongoing, but I think as part of the routine standard of clinical care in the regular doctor's or community oncologist office, we should not just stop the tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Another big topic is what are the treatment side effects and the late effects? I may want to reword this a little bit differently because CML is a chronic disease, and those BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase inhibitors need to be taken continuously. And Dr. Mauro was mentioning the importance of taking your drug every day, because there's a direct correlation and a direct connection between the days and the numbers of pills missed per month and less well-treated CML. So a patient truly should not miss a lot of their dosages doing a month, because it can, even if you think you're only missing one or two dosages or pills each month, this already can have a negative impact. So adherence is truly crucial, I would say, as mentioned earlier as well. So having said this, CML treatment is a chronic, continuous treatment for many years. So you will see your doctor many times, your healthcare providers, your doctor, the nurse practitioner, and everybody involved in the care of the patient with CML. Initially, when medications are started, there are several monitoring. So we need to look at the blood tests. We need to look at, for some of the medications, for example, nilotinib, we do EKGs to assess the heart rhythm, because some of those medications can alter the heart rhythm and so forth. We monitor how well the CML responds. Initially, every 3 months, that's a blood test, and we can look at the molecularly assess how many CML cells are left in the bloodstream, and we want to see a decrease of 1,000 or 10,000 fold over, and even to a greater degree later on, over a period of 3 to 6 or 6 to 12 months. So it's very important that you actually do follow up with your doctor as recommended every few months, and your doctor will lay it out to you how often he wants to see you. The first several years is probably every 3 months, or at least the blood tests and this BCR-ABL molecular test should be done every 3 months. There's also side effects when patients are on treatment with a different TKIs. For example, with imatinib or Gleevec, we see rash, we see diarrhea, sometimes nausea and vomiting. Long-term complications we see in some patients are muscle pain and muscle cramps, as well as fluid retention. So it is important that you tell your doctor about the different side effects. For example, if there's a rash, one can stop the drug for a week or 2 weeks and see if the rash goes away. There's topical medications or topical steroids that can be given. If you have nausea and vomiting, for example, you can take your imatinib or Gleevec with food and with a big glass of water, for example. For muscle cramps, you can take some magnesium or calcium that's sometimes recommended. Drink a tonic water. Don't go overboard with drinking tonic water. So there's a couple of things that can be recommended by your doctor to minimize those side effects. Speaking about nilotinib or Tasigna, it's a second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and some of the common side effects are elevations of some of the liver function tests. So there can be an impact on the liver. So if a doctor puts you on nilotinib or Tasigna, the doctor should monitor your liver function tests, your lipase, amylase. So I'm just throwing out a couple of those names. So monitoring of your liver function, as well as every couple of weeks or every couple of months, there should be an EKG done to look at the electrical function and the electrical conduction of the heart. And I think it's also important to mention, if you're on nilotinib specifically, but for all of those TKIs, if you start a new medication, you should let your doctor who treats you for the CML know. Because there may be side effects even with harmless antibiotics or another blood pressure medication another doctor wants to put you on. I would check either with your doctor who wants to start this medication, point out that you are on a certain medication for your CML, or this doctor should check back with your oncologist or hematologist who treats you. Because there can be interactions of these medications with your tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Talking about dasatinib or Sprycel, another very good drug we've heard, long-term complications or long-term late effects are fluid retention. Essentially, the body keeps too much of fluid, and the fluid accumulates. Patients can develop edema of their legs, and in the worst-case scenario, patients can develop pleural effusion. That's fluid between the lung and the ribcage, so to speak. I think it's important to mention that not every patient develops every of those side effects. So, in generally, those drugs are very well tolerated, and many patients do not develop any side effects. So it's a fraction of those patients, but if those side effects occur, or if you have a suspicion that there's something new, just let your doctor or your healthcare team know. Maybe another side effect for several of the drugs, particularly of ponatinib, which is another tyrosine kinase inhibitor, that's often given for more advanced and more resistant CML, as well as now recently for nilotinib, those drugs can have an effect on the vasculature. By the vasculature, I mean There are some observations and some reports that vascular disease, such as peripheral vascular disease or coronary artery disease or even heart attacks, can occur. So if you have any vascular problems or any heart problems, tell your doctor about it, your CML doctor about it, and he can look into it. What is the best drug for you? And fortunately, we do have several drugs available. There are three approved for upfront treatment. There are two other drugs approved, ponatinib and bosutinib, that can be given if one or the other drugs are not tolerable or don't work as well. If the benefits of follow-up care, let me touch on that for a few minutes. Despite the success in treating with those BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase inhibitor, I mentioned that close monitoring, both for an appropriate and adequate response of the CML and disappearance of the CML to those medications, is very crucial, as well as managing the long-term side effects, as I pointed out earlier. So it is important to stay connected with your doctor, follow up every few months or every 3 to 6 months, depending what the follow-up schedule is and what time. With that, also, it's important that you communicate with the healthcare team. Although CML has become a chronic disease for most patients, we still need to monitor patients carefully. I talked about the quality of life and the long-term side effects. And there are other special or specific situations. For example, if they're younger patients now being treated in their 30s or 40s, and some of them may want to get pregnant. So I think it's too much to go into details here, but there's a possibility that women may incorporate and may get pregnant if they have CML, but this requires close monitoring and formulating a treatment plan with their healthcare team or with their doctor. And if your doctor is not familiar with specific circumstances or special situations, ask your doctor if there's anybody in the surrounding at a larger cancer center who may see more CML patients and can help out or co-share for certain specific situations like pregnancy or something else. And I think with that, I probably do want to stop. Maybe I do want to add that fortunately most patients do respond, and over time many of those responses actually get deeper. That means in simple terms is the longer you're on the treatment, the less the risk or chance that the CML comes back, but only if you continue taking your medications. If the CML comes back despite appropriate treatment and medication adherence, we do have a choice between different tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Doctors can do fancy molecular testing. They can test for mutations. So at any point, if the drug you're on stops working, you can ask your doctor, just throw it out there, you know, doctor, is it worthwhile doing mutation testing or mutation analysis? Because we have learned that certain of the drugs may be effective while one of the other drugs may no longer be affected, and that is based on the molecular features and some of the mutations found in the CML cells. So with that, I would like to close and turn it back over to Caroline.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Tibbs. That was really wonderful and, again, very informative for our participants. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Anna Eckhart. Ms. Eckhart is our online support group program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she will be addressing the free psychosocial services that you can access from Cancer Care, our programs and services, as well as the role of support groups. It's really my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Eckhart.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's really wonderful to be part of this important conversation about helping patients and loved ones cope with and attempt to understand CML. I want to begin by speaking broadly and then more specifically about our services. So there are many ways that Cancer Care can be part of your network, and there are many ways we can help. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. And as social workers, we would argue that it is an essential part. At Cancer Care, we're a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. All our services are provided by licensed, master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. we're trained on how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. And we're trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, psychological impact, and overall care. And additionally, we provide education about resources and how to help navigate the healthcare system, how to help find practical help, and discuss some limited financial assistance. I want to also talk about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer or caring for someone with cancer. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You do not have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have a similar problem. You can share experiences and learn from each other. And group members provide a listening ear and share tips and resources that they've utilized along the way. Cancer care support groups are moderated by our oncology social workers. We offer face-to-face support groups, as well as telephone and online groups. And currently, for those diagnosed with CML, we offer an online blood cancer support group. Our groups run for 15 weeks, and it's for people who are diagnosed with a blood cancer who are currently receiving treatment. CML patients who are finished with active treatment may want to join our post-treatment survivorship group. And the themes discussed in this group include talking about the emotional anticipation of upcoming tests, procedures, distancing of support of family and friends, the fear of recurrence, the chronic nature of the disease, things like that. The online support group allows people from all over the world to share and write about their experiences. And you can visit our website at cancercare.org, and this would be the first step in the registration and screening for this group and all of our online groups. Caregivers can access support through our telephone and online caregiver support groups, and these groups provide a safe, supportive environment for sharing the feelings and discussing the challenges, as well as the rewards of being a caregiver. You know, it's a space that's just their own, and speaking of, you know, as someone who moderates one of the caregiver groups, I know that it's a space that the caregivers really greatly appreciate. We have a young adult program, and we offer caregiver online support groups for people between the ages of 20 and 39 years of age whose loved one has cancer. So this is a unique program. We have a young adult online spouse and partner group and a young adult general caregiver group for someone who might have a parent or friend with CML. And if you choose to pursue individual counseling, this type of support provides a space that is just yours to voice any concerns. All of these connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. And feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment overall. So if you're interested in any of these services, you can call Cancer Care's Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673, or if it's one of the online support groups that is interesting you, then visit the website. Again, it's www.cancercare.org. I'd like to end by stating that just a reminder that you are not alone. Our services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk with you all today.
Oh, thank you so much. Anna, we work together at Cancer Care. Anna's a wonderful oncology social worker who has really developed extensively our online support group program and many other things as well. So it's a very good example for you to hear the different services that we offer. And now
we have
time for questions. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And and now we do have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I want to thank our speakers. And I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, please know that you can call us at 1-800-813-4673. 813-HOPE, and our oncology social work staff will, of course, address your questions. And I'll repeat this number again at the end of the call, but why don't we see how many of your questions we can take right now. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit a question by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Judy Z. Your line is open.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank everyone who participated in this, the doctors and our social worker. I so appreciate it. Okay. The first question is, I was diagnosed 6 years ago. I am doing fantastically well on Sprycel. To make it easy, there is no trace of my disease for basically almost the beginning. But I have been on Prilosec, and I'm hearing mention of maybe not taking that type of drug. And I do have GERD, and I wanted to know, and I do have one other important question, but I wanted to know if that is a problem, if that is in any way lessening the effect of my Sprycel.
Okay, and would you want to ask your second question as well? So with both your questions.
Sure. I suffer from severe muscle and joint pain, and none of my doctors have a clue whether it's being caused by the Sprycel, the CML itself, or Crestor. And I have familial hyperlipidemia, so I need to be on something or my numbers literally go off the charts. So I was wondering if anybody could help me with that, because I'm just not able to get any answers. All my docs are scratching their heads on that one.
Okay, well, we're going to do our best. We'll probably answer your question. I want to thank you, Judy, for your questions. And our speakers will address your question in a general way, and then we're hoping that you can take that information back to your treating healthcare team. So I'm going to ask if Dr. Morrow would address the first question and then Dr. Tebis the second. So Dr. Morrow, would you like to take the first question, please?
Sure. I think I should, because I mentioned the drug interaction. So we know from some experience that taking medication that changes your stomach acid will affect the absorption of TKIs. Now, the case that we just heard of, I'm so pleased to hear that she's doing so well. I think the proof's in the pudding, and that her response has been phenomenal, and she's been undetectable for a long period of time. So I think our worry about there not being enough drug exposure is probably small to none. But it's important to note that in reality, someone's exposure to a drug like particularly Sprycel, probably to a lesser degree to Cigna, and also lesser degree to Gleevec, without a little bit of acid in the stomach, the drug absorption is less, and it can be as much as 50 to 60% of what you might be taking if your stomach acid is completely blocked. So it's an important question to raise. It doesn't mean that it never can happen together, and it's a inevitable disaster. It's more of an avoidance strategy, and some people do need to take medicines like that for GERD or stomach-related complications or GI conditions, and we just have to adjust our treatment, our expectation. We have to monitor for a good response, perhaps change the dose accordingly, I think that that hopefully explains that point I made to everyone, that it's not a it's a contraindication, but it's something that we often have to deal with.
Excellent. Very helpful. So, Judy, I hope you'll take this back to your treating healthcare team, and that will be hopefully helpful to you and your team. And then, Dr. Teams, could you address your second question about the muscle and joint pain?
Well, it's a difficult one.
In a general way, of course, because, of course, maybe others, if this, and then we'll...
So, I mean, the TKIs can cause muscle cramps and then muscle pain. So often in the lower extremities, meaning in the legs, often happens at night, not always. I forgot, is our participant, is she on one of the statins as well?
She's on Sprycel. She didn't say, but she has hyperlipidemia, so she didn't indicate the other stat, what she's taking, but she did indicate that she is on...
She didn't
say what it was, but I think she does have to take something, yes.
I think I heard she mentioned she's on Crestor.
Crestor, correct, yeah. So Crestor, so that's, you know, it's important. So because a drug class called the statins, like simvastatin, atorvastatin, they can cause muscle pain and muscle inflammation. Crestor less, to my knowledge. So, you know, that's something. So there may not be another major medication around there, so it could be related to the TKI. The question is, you know, what are the measures have been taking, or if anything can avoid those CRAMs in terms of measures that have been taken by their doctors. Having high triglycerides, and if it's a familial component to it, they should be appropriately treated. There are some other medications for triglycerides that can be tested. Crestor is a rather new one, but there's some other ones, if they haven't been tested, that could be discussed with your doctor. In terms of, I agree with Dr. Mauro, in terms of the suppression of the CML, this means the patient is probably getting enough of the statinib in the bloodstream to suppress the CML. Fluoxetine or Prozac, I think, is a inhibitor. So there may be a little higher levels of dasatinib in the bloodstream. It is a complicated question, and I think this is probably the best I can say from the distance. If other things have been ruled out, you can check some muscle enzymes as well to see if there's a muscle inflammation. You know, despite being on dasatinib, it may be worthwhile changing to another tyrosine kinase inhibitor if those muscle pain, muscle cramps, or musculoskeletal complaints are too much to bear and impact the quality of life. So we have choices of switching to another tyrosine kinase inhibitor. But that would really need to be done in the individual scenario. And if those other general side effects, if we can't pinpoint to something else, are so compromising of the quality of life, I sometimes change the tyrosine kinase inhibitor. But then, again, carefully monitoring if the other tyrosine kinase inhibitor achieves the same suppression of the CML, because that's important as well.
Excellent. I guess I'm going to ask a question just in general, but both of you. Do you involve, like, a team when people do have symptoms or muscle aches and that complexity of issues? Do you sometimes involve a pain team or a palliative care team in those situations? And Dr. Moore, is that something that is used as a standard or not? It isn't, actually. It is first assessed by the hematologist-oncologist and only brought in if it's hard to figure these things out, which clearly it often is sometimes with, I think, the drug interactions and things like that.
I think it's important for providers and patients to hear that as easy as CML treatment may sound, it's obviously a serious condition with chemotherapy and medications with side effects, and our first line of defense needs to be very good intake and understanding of side effects. Anything that's relevant we need to hear about so we can triage as a hematologist. And the hematology or the oncology team that's managing someone with CML needs to know when to ask for help, when to ask questions about relationship to medicine, relationship to other medicines, relationship to something completely different that needs to be evaluated. And we routinely will bring in other specialists, whether it's someone to help with pain and a palliative care service. I'm calling on dermatologists, gastroenterologists, neurologists, different specialists for different side effects, so we can really take care of someone who's really running a marathon of CML treatment, and they need to be, you know, they need those water stops and that support through the race all the way through. So that's my approach.
Excellent. Thank you. I hope that's helpful to everybody to be aware of that. There's a whole team out there. And also, when someone is really feeling that their team is stumped, what about the concept of, and again, just a general concept of seeking a second opinion or getting some additional, just a look at the at one's situation. Is that something that's often recommended when everyone seems stumped of what to do?
I can just make a quick comment again. This is, yes, Michael Morrow. I'd like to change the term second opinion to how can I help, because I think people who take care of lots of patients with CML, I think we all of us as a community often feel it's our job to help make important decisions, give guidance on monitoring, give guidance on side effects. We know people are living well and they're out of the hospital and they often need a care team, not just a single specialist. Sometimes that's the best. My colleague mentioned specific circumstances like pregnancy if it comes up and treatment discontinuation where we might have some trials or some particular expertise where that's something we ought to do. But it is a team approach, and I encourage everyone to never be shy about asking for other opinion. And for healthcare team, that it's not our intention to absorb all the patients into our larger centers. We know that people need to be cared for in a collaborative fashion.
Excellent, thank you. And our next question, Stephanie.
And maybe
oh, yes,
if I can
sorry,
add
yes.
to that, you know, Michael, it's a very good point actually. You know, we haven't mentioned the pharmacist yet. So not everybody has access to a clinical pharmacist, but, you know, pharmacists are a great resource as well, or clinical pharmacists. You know, you can find in some large offices or practices or community cancer centers or in academic cancer centers for those questions, because there is a long list of medications that can interact. So in the situation we heard, not to go back to that scenario, but just in general, if there's something, we have to look into interactions of drugs or something else. And part of the team is a pharmacist who can help us tease out those specific questions as well.
That's an excellent point. Thank you. Excellent. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Barbara A. Your line is open.
Oh, thank you. I was wondering about the clinical trials. Isn't it a little bit risky for, you know, the patients to go under the clinical trials? Because what if they don't get the medications that they need? Couldn't they, you know, have serious problems?
Oh, yeah, Barbara, that's such an important question. I'm going to ask Dr. Tibbs to address that because it's often a perception that people have. Dr. Tibbs, could you address that, please?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think it's important to mention that most cancer trials, almost all cancer trials, there are some exceptions that do not have what we call a placebo, because it's often felt that it's not ethical to treat cancer patients or patients with chronic leukemias or chronic cancers or chronic diseases, for that matter, with a placebo. There are some exceptions. So most of the time, what we call the comparator arm should be the standard. So in the attempt to not, so the patient should always at least receive a standard or what is right now the current standard of therapy. And the goal of trials is to assess, is adding another drug or substituting another drug as good or better. So most trials have that built in to at least as good or not much worse or not worse than what is the standard your doctor should do or would do anyhow. You know, in cardiology and some other trials, sometimes you have a placebo, but often in cancer trials, you don't have that. The initial trial for how imatinib or Gleevec was approved was comparing it to interferon and to ARA-C, which was the previous standard. But even during that time, many felt it's already substandard because we know that imatinib was so much better. So there was a big controversy back then. So right now, I don't see any trials for CML where a patient would not at least receive one of the standard drugs. The other big research question right now is, or clinical trial question is, the discontinuation. And I think it's important that patients only be discontinued from their tyrosine kinase inhibitor after a few years, and the trial's a little different, and there has to be a documented, very, very deep molecular response, meaning almost undetectable CML for a few years prior to stopping. And then the second question is, how quick does the CML come back? And by closely monitoring every couple of weeks or every couple of months, the doctor can tell, well, we stopped your drug, but the CML is back. Let's put you back on right away. So this can't be done in a community office or so, or shouldn't be done, because we're still learning with that. So if a patient is interested of stopping any TKI because they have side effects, they don't want to take the pill, there's a high copay, they want to get pregnant, the clinical trial is just offering the possibility of doing that, but with a greater safety net for the patient by doctors that see more CML patients and have a little bit more experience, or if they don't see many CML patients, they have a very rigorous schedule that the patient is closely followed. So if the CML would come back, we would detect it right away and put the patient back on. So it's not that the doctors don't want to do this, or it's not that the doctors want to take off the patient from the CML medication. Often it's the CML patient asking, can we take it off? So what we're doing right now, we're seeing, can we take patients off? But that has to be done very carefully in a very well close monitored setting, that it doesn't pose much risk for the patient. So in a way, we're just learning together as a community of doctors and patients, can we do it, should we do it? And then, you know, this is where right now for CMLs, the clinical trials are coming in. I hope that answered the question.
Excellent. Thank you. We have a question from one of our online participants. When is it appropriate to consider a bone marrow transplant? Dr. Morrow, could you address that question?
Sure. So bone marrow transplant is still a very powerful tool for CML. It's important to note that prior to the availability of TKI, CML was one of the most curable diseases via bone marrow transplant. Of course, most people are able to benefit significantly from medications like Gleevec and what are called the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, but there are certainly still people who that isn't the right answer for the long term. And the kind of categories that often includes are people who have had progression of CML to a more advanced form, either right at the beginning or because of a gap that the treatment wasn't enough or the treatment didn't serve them well enough and they relapsed or progressed. A very young patient or someone who has a very low risk of complications from a bone marrow transplant who hasn't had the type of success we would expect from medications. They may have moved on to a second or a third therapy. We have a bit of a challenge with some of our newest therapies and envisioning how people might be able to take them over the very long term due to some questions about side effects. So those are the kind of scenarios that exist. So I encourage everyone who's of reasonable age in whom a bone marrow transplant would be considered to definitely ask about that question. And it may be as simple as getting a blood test or having a patient and their loved ones or just the patient having blood tests and us doing a computer search and us being able to understand, are there potential donors? And that's really the first step. So bone marrow transplant is still a curative option, something to consider, and something that is the right answer often if the CML has progressed or if the CML seems difficult to treat and the risk of the bone marrow transplant is low. And that's a very individualized decision that should happen in the hands of a transplant expert to explain to someone what the risks of the procedure are and why one might want to proceed.
And thank you very much. That's excellent. And there's another question from Linda online. So is it safe to get pregnant when a man is on Gleevec? Dr. Tito, can you address that question?
Well, you know, that's a good question. So this has not been systematically studied or evaluated. So there are, you know, we call this case reports, meaning, you know, we didn't study this on a clinical trial, meaning, you know, looking at 100 men, 50 became pregnant while on imatinib or some of those drugs, and 50 didn't. So often those are just like information. We look back and say, well, you know, at two cancer centers or two treatment centers over the last 10 years, there were 13 men that fathered a child or, you know, became pregnant while they were taking imatinib. And now we're looking back, how did the babies and the mothers and everybody else do? So the experience is still limited. it seems, you know, it's hard to give advice over the phone. So maybe the points are there is limited experience with tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Some of the reports say that, you know, there was some voluntary abortion, right, for those concerns. And there were one spontaneous abortion and one serious. Again, this was only 13 or 15 patients. So I think I want to say that our information and our knowledge is still very limited. There may be a potential harm. There were a few babies born normally and healthy. I think it's truly best if you know, the man discussed it with their doctor. And that may be one of the scenarios. If the patient has been in a very good remission, deep molecular remission for several years, you know, enroll in the trial, stop their imatinib or stop their tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and maybe in those 1 or 2 years window, there may be the chance of fathering a baby. So that's probably what I would say and recommend at this point.
Thank you. And Dr. Morrow, did you want to add anything?
Sure. I think that's wise advice. I think we've since the early days of TKIs, we've seen restrictions lifted on having normal, healthy adult sexual activity, amongst male patients who have CML. That there doesn't seem to be a need for special contraception. Although, of course, contraception to avoid pregnancy is. But this, we're talking about the opposite question, about trying to achieve pregnancy. And the only other point I'd make is, if someone does father a child and they're on CML therapy, that probably the best thing is to consider that the pregnancy might be higher risk and avail the woman and the child to the care of a higher risk obstetrician. So all the right, early diagnostics can be done to make sure the baby's health is well, and obviously to check in on the mother, although I think the main concern is about the product of that conception, the baby. That's often helpful.
Excellent. What a wonderful team. And the question for you, Anna, actually from one of the participants. So what tips can you give regarding building a support network? Because we've talked about a lot of things on the call today, and just any thoughts that you would have about just building a support network to deal with the stress and some of the concerns that people may have.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I can definitely address that. So, one thing when I think about tips is, well, just taking the time to just think about who in your life is available to be a support, and, making a list of that, of those people, and knowing and really being thoughtful of what their strengths are in terms of their time, in terms of their emotional availability, and just in terms of how they've been there for you. And with that, I do think that it is important to realize, and I think that many people who've already been through or are going through this know that even the people that in your life that you do feel are incredibly supportive and involved, that they may not be as involved while you're in treatment, or that their support changes or is limited. And I think that is, I think in terms of developing a support system, having like a social worker, or having a confidant, having someone that you can talk to on a face-to-face or over the phone type of way, just to be able to process that, because that is a loss when the people in your life often are not as involved or supportive as you would like them to be or need them to be. Something that I do discuss in terms of broadening the support system is asking friends and family to help you with a list of the practical tips, practical things that you do around the house that you need help with. There is a really great website called Lots of Helping Hands. It's part of the My Cancer Circle, and it's a way for people in your life who want to be involved can do that. They can sign up for, doing your laundry or mowing the front lawn or picking up someone from after school or from an activity. You would get an email alert. The person who has signed up for this activity gets an email alert. And often this is something that not the the patient does, but a close friend who wants to help organize the support. So in terms of the support network, this is a great way to organize it. It's a great way for people to feel involved. Oftentimes they'll say, call me if you need something, don't hesitate, and then you never hear from them again. Or you ask for something and they're not able to follow through. People really like practical ways that are to help, that are time sensitive and often kind of like wrapped up in either like it's a meal or picking up someone, and it's up to them within the My Cancer Circle if they'd like to be able to do that on a weekly basis, on a regular basis. And I think just having that allows you as a person who's going through this to have a little bit more time in terms of recovery, in terms of rest, in terms of focusing on the medical questions that you have, the financial concerns that often come up when some of the practical needs are being addressed in a way that you don't have to stress and think about in the same way. So that's just a few ideas I had about the support system.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. That's a wonderful support tips for people. And I want to thank all of our speakers today. What a remarkable team of experts on this call today, and also what a remarkable group of participants on the call today. You were really amazing, had great questions, and lots of different scope of questions as well, which we really appreciate. I really want to thank everyone for participating. And I want to remind you a little bit more just about the services that you can access from Cancer Care, because I think that that's so important for all of you to actually to be aware of. So We haven't yet ended the call yet. So I want to just quickly review with you the services that you can access from Cancer Care, which Anna had reviewed very carefully with you, but I just want to quickly summarize them. And so those services include just a host of different things, and they're all free, from counseling services, a chance to talk with somebody here at Cancer Care, to actually practical and financial assistance with some concerns you may have, being able to listen to these types of programs, and also our publications, and of course our website, and most importantly, to have a place that you can call when you have a concern. And again, I want to go over with you our 800 number. It's 1-800-813-HOPE. And indeed, you may think of a question after today's call, or in a couple of days, or next week, or next month, and please do call us. We are simply a phone call away, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, as we conclude the call today, I would not want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with CML. It is a feeling that sometimes one has. But I do want you to know that you are really linked to an organization that can assist you with whatever your concern might be. And I would say go ahead and try us. It's free, and it's a quick call or a visit to our website. And take advantage of these services. And, of course, all the services that we've made available to you, the different resources that are listed in the materials that we've sent you. And, of course, do send in your evaluation forms. We appreciate your feedback. It helps us to build these programs and to make them more relevant to meet your needs. So tell us the topics you'd like us to offer. We're planning lots of programs for 2015, and your suggestions really help us to keep the programs most relevant for each of your needs. Thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.